Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Testing Psychologist podcast, the podcast where we talk all about the business and practice of psychological and neuropsychological assessment. I'm your host, Dr. Jeremy Sharp, licensed psychologist, group practice owner, and private practice coach.
This episode is brought to you by PAR. PAR offers the Spectra Indices of Psychopathology, a hierarchical, dimensional look at adult psychopathology. The Spectra is available for paper and pencil assessment or administration and scoring via PARI Connect. Learn more at parinc.com/spectra. That's S-P-E-C-T-R-A.
All right, y'all. Welcome to the Testing Psychologist podcast. Today's topic is forensic assessment. We've talked about forensic assessment in different formats over the years, but today I am talking with Dr. Casey Magnall, and we are talking about the overlap and differentiation between forensic assessment and clinical assessment. So Casey got her doctorate in clinical psychology from the University of Denver. She completed her predoctoral internship at Utah State Hospital, where she did her first dive into forensics and was instantly obsessed with forensic psychology. So she went on to complete a postdoc in forensic psychology at Utah State Hospital. She's received training in a variety of forensic evaluations, including competency to proceed, mental state evaluations, violence risk assessments, and psychosexual evaluations. She also runs a private practice offering a blend of clinical and forensic evaluations, including both criminal and civil forensic evals. While she's passionate about psychological evaluations, she has many interests outside of the profession, including being active outdoors and the amazing statistic that she once walked 2,660 miles from Mexico to Canada. Sadly, we did not get into that story, but I now know why I'm going to have Casey back on the podcast at some point. So this is a really cool conversation. We get into many things related to forensics. We talk about major differences between forensic and outpatient assessment, then get into a more detailed discussion of effort testing among individuals with suspected intellectual disability. We chat about the value of standardized testing in forensic settings and strategies for gathering collateral data and records and many other things. As usual, there's a lot to take away from this conversation. Now, if you're a practice owner and you'd like some support with your practice development, I would love to help you. You can check out the Testing Psychologist Mastermind Groups, which are group coaching experiences aimed at all levels of practice. A group of psychologists get together, we support one another, we hold each other accountable, and the hope is it gives you a little boost to reach any goals you may have set for your practice. You can get more info at thetestingpsychologist.com/consulting. All right, let's jump to my conversation with Dr. Casey Magnall. Hey, Casey, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
I'm glad to have you. Glad to have you. You're a fellow former Colorado person, right? You came from DU.
Yes. Yeah. I had a 4-year stint in Colorado on the Front Range.
Sure. Sure. And it's way better than Utah, right?
Yeah. I think everyone should move to Colorado. Like, don't come to Utah.
You're like, what do I say right now? Sorry. I'm ambushing you right off the bat. No, Utah is amazing. So many cool spots. I'm glad to have you here. You know, forensic assessment is an area that certainly falls outside my scope of expertise. And so I think it gets a little less airtime here on the podcast. So I'm always thankful to have folks who are more skilled in forensic stuff to come on and chat with us. So yeah, I'm excited to talk with you. Before we get into everything, though, you are one of those folks that has to do one of those disclaimers, so we'll make a little space for you to do that now, and then we can get into our conversation.
Yeah, so since I kind of wear two hats, I run a private practice, but then I also work full-time for, my immediate employer is the Utah State Hospital under the umbrella of the Department of Health and Human Services, and so just a little disclaimer to say that, you know, the opinions that I express on here are my own and that I'm not representing the state hospital or DHHS. And I guess this is also not legal advice.
Of course. Of course. All right. We got that out of the way. Let's get into the good stuff. So I'll open with the question that I always open with, which is why spend time on this? I mean, out of everything that you could do with your life and your degree, why this area?
Yeah, I don't know that I have like a concise, satisfying response to that. I just came into every aspect of psychology in a roundabout way. In undergraduate school, I studied English literature. I really liked the process of identifying themes and finding parallels and making comparison between things that seemed really different. And so once I got into psychology, I, you know, found that that process was also very similar, especially in testing. But I spent a long time after undergrad not really knowing what I wanted to pursue and what was meaningful to me. And I stumbled into psychology years after graduating and fell in love with it and had the opportunity to get into learn about testing by working as a psychometrist. And that, I mean, that immediately really got me of just that process of, you know, picking out the data points and then figuring out, you know, what's the pattern, what connects these data points and how to make sense of it and how to give someone this really comprehensive picture through these disparate data points. And then forensics also came much later. I didn't really have that training, the formal training and experience in graduate school. I didn't know that I was interested in forensics at the time. I was mostly just interested in testing. And then when I matched at the Utah State Hospital for my pre-doctoral internship, I was really excited because I knew I'd be doing forensic evaluations. And so I implicitly, I think, equated that with doing these really comprehensive evaluations with lots of different testing. Discovered that that's not necessarily the case, that testing is not inherent in it. But I think what I've really loved, obviously there's plenty of testing in forensics, but I've really just loved that process of taking what I know about psychology and about testing and then applying it to this realm outside of psychology. So to a totally different kind of question. It's really honed my skills, I think, as a clinician and really made me step outside of that comfort zone and outside of that box. So it's just, it's a really enjoyable process for me.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I know we're going to talk a lot about that and some of these parallels and a lot of the differences between, you know, forensic assessment and quote unquote regular assessment. But I like hearing your story. It sounds similar to my own and I think to a lot of folks where, you know, you don't have to know exactly what you want to do from the beginning of grad school or undergrad or anything like that. And there's lots of twists and turns along the path as we go along.
Absolutely. I mean, I think I'm, because of that, a huge advocate for like being open to different experiences along the way. And even if you feel like you know what you want to do, like maybe it'll change. And I think I'm glad that I was open because I don't think I would have found forensics if I had more of a laser focus on what I thought I wanted to do when I went into grad school.
Yeah. 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 I'm glad to hear that. I think it's important for other folks to hear too, especially, you know, folks in grad school. Things can change. Things can really change. I did both of my internship and my postdoc in college counseling centers, which sounds crazy at this point. And people are, you know, come in and when I meet them, they're like, how did you go from college counseling to testing? So there's plenty of ways to get where you're supposed to go. So we are going to talk a lot about forensic assessment today. And I thought a place for us to start might be just, I would love to get your thoughts on some of the major differences between forensic assessment on the whole and neuropsych testing or whatever. I'm not sure what we want to contrast it with or what term we want to use. Maybe that's even a great place to start.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I think oftentimes, like in the forensic literature on this topic, it's contrasted with therapeutic evaluation or therapeutic assessment. And that's not like capital T therapeutic assessment, like the school of assessment that's really rooted in that therapeutic process, but just to contrast it, meaning like evaluation that's meant for assessment, diagnosis, and treatment planning. You could also call them clinical evaluations, but I think a lot of forensic evaluations are also clinical evaluations. They're just in a forensic context. So I typically contrast it with the forensic evaluation with a therapeutic evaluation.
Yeah. Yeah, that's fair. And just to be super clear, yeah, we're not talking about therapeutic assessment as a modality, as the, you know, the theoretical orientation, so to speak, but just the field of assessment as a whole, non-forensic assessment. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Great. Great. So yeah, let's lay out, I mean, just some of the basic differences, core differences that you have identified.
Yeah. So, I mean, one, even just starting with who the client is, right? So a lot of times in a therapeutic evaluation, the client is going to be the same as the examinee, or, you know, it might be a parent or something like that. But in forensics, it's less often that the examinee is the same as the client. And so, you know, when it comes to court-ordered evaluations, the court is the client. A lot of times an attorney will request the evaluation, so then they're the client. So just that alone can get a little murky and requires a little bit of clarification, but that difference alone can really dictate a lot of difference in sort of the purpose, nature, and scope of a forensic evaluation. So when it comes to the goal of a forensic evaluation, the goal is to assist the fact finder in making a legal decision, you know, as opposed to in therapeutic evaluation, the goal being to provide accurate diagnosis, relevant treatment recommendations. So with that difference in goals, there's a difference in the role of the evaluator. So in a therapeutic evaluation, the role is really more, I guess you could say, helping or an advocate for the client in a way, right? Like you want them to just get the best treatment possible, whatever that's going to look like for them. As opposed to in a forensic evaluation, the role is more helping the court or the fact finder. And so, you know, that it's not necessarily about getting the examinee, you know, treatment or things like that. And sometimes the effect can be, you know, problematic for the defendant or the examinee. So there's, I think, a lot more risk involved in those kinds of evaluations.
Yeah, I would love to talk at some point. Maybe we can bookmark this, just how you thread that needle in, you know, building rapport, building trust, when in the back of your mind, you know, whether you're saying it explicitly or not, that the results of the evaluation are may not go in this person's favor. And there, you know, it's hard not to think that there's a manipulation involved there. I'm sure there's a better word and a better like rationalization, but I'd be curious how you navigate through that.
Yeah, totally. We can circle back to that.
Yeah. Great. Great. Yeah. I'm going to make a note and we will come back, but yeah, let's keep talking about these differences and keep a big picture view, and then we'll dive deep into some of these areas.
So I think because the issue in a forensic evaluation is helping answer a legal question, forensic evaluations tend to be a bit more narrow and focused in their scope. you know, a neuropsych evaluation can get pretty broad and pretty comprehensive pretty quickly of covering all these different areas. Whereas in forensics, it's really just, well, what data do I need to collect in order to answer this very specific legal question? Like, is this person competent to proceed in their legal case, or did they have the capacity to form the mental state at the time of the alleged offense? So really specific questions, and they end up being a lot more narrow in their scope in terms of what kinds of data is collected. I think there's also a difference in terms of the standards that guide the evaluation process. So in therapeutic evaluations, the focus is really on clinical standards. So like the psychometric properties of a test and kind of the nature of the question, the referral question. In forensics, there are also legal standards to consider, right? So different states have different statutes that will guide what needs to be included in the evaluation. Like in Utah, we have a really, I guess, robust, detailed guide in our statute about what we need to include in our competency evaluations. And then there's also just some legal standards or rules about, you know, what qualifies someone to be an expert. And so thinking about those things when you're thinking about test selection, like, has this test been subject to peer review? Is there a known error rate? Things like that. And if you want, we can get into that in more detail. I think that might be getting into the weeds, but just to say that there are some legal standards to consider in forensic evaluations.
Sure. Maybe I could ask a question about that at least quickly. And is it fair to say then that you, maybe not anymore, maybe you've learned this information over the years, but at some point, were you then like paying more attention to test selection, knowing that it might come under, the battery might come under more scrutiny than a therapeutic evaluation?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's just always this thought process of like, if I were called to testify, would there be any issues raised regarding this test that I used? It's a hard thing to anticipate, but just thinking about the properties of it and any kind of limitations or weakness in the test. And, you know, if there are some major problems with that test and I still choose to use it, having some really clear rationale about why I'm using it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Or maybe why I'm using a test in a way that's not necessarily, it wasn't developed to be used.
Sure. Can you, let's take a little detour for a second. Can you give me examples of tests that you really wouldn't give a second thought about? Like, these are pretty well established, like I don't have to worry about these being questioned. And then maybe an example or two of tests that are a little more questionable, or ones that you might anticipate more questions about them or about the psychometrics.
Yeah. I mean, I think the standard cognitive assessments that we have out there, like the WACE or Stanford-Binet, have tons of research, tons of, you know, norms. We know a lot about those measures. Those are clinical measures. I think in terms of forensic measures, looking at tests that look at response style or response bias. So things like the TOM or Green's word memory. So those tests have a lot of research behind them, pretty robust data collection, right, that went into developing them. And then I think there's some research to suggest that just in general, more projective style tests are not as credible to the court system. The more face valid that a test is, those tests tend to be more accepted by the court system. And even though, so for example, like the Rorschach, plenty of people use the Rorschach in forensic evaluations, and I think it's improved with the RPAS, you know, scoring system. But for example, if you were to use the comprehensive system or the Exner scoring system, there are some known problems with that scoring system, right? So just, I personally would be nervous about using that approach or using that test in an evaluation.
Sure, sure. That's fair. Yeah, thanks for detouring me into that for a bit. Yeah. Are there major differences that we may need to be aware of? Things you think about?
Yeah, I mean, I think even just the source of information. So I think the sources are this very similar in forensic and therapeutic evaluations, but I think the weight that is given to different kinds of data is different. So certainly in therapeutic evaluations, we collect, you know, we review collateral data like interviews with people who know the examinee or review records. But that is just a much bigger part, I think, of forensic evaluations, given that, you know, I think there's just a higher risk of potential just inaccurate information maybe given by an examinee, given the high stakes of the situation. And so a lot more weight is kind of given to those collateral interviews, review of records. And I think just that process is much more extensive. Like it's not weird for me to review hundreds and hundreds of pages of records for a case in a forensic situation, whereas not super common in a therapeutic evaluation.
Sure.
And I think too, so forensics may give a little more weight to the collateral information. And testing is, I think, less common, depending on the type of forensic evaluation that you're doing, right? Whereas I think testing is a huge part of therapeutic evaluations. I mean, it would be not to say that in every single therapeutic evaluation, clinicians give some sort of standardized measure, but definitely the norm, right? It's more common than not to give some testing.
Of course. Yeah. 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 You've said that a couple of times. I want to double click on that a little bit. This idea that testing isn't necessarily a big part of forensic assessment. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. I think it kind of goes back to this issue about the purpose of a forensic evaluation to answer some sort of legal question. And so we could talk about the different kinds of, like, the different categories of tests. But there are very few tests out there that assess some sort of legal construct or some sort of psycholegal construct. Most of the tests that we have measure some sort of clinical construct like personality or intelligence or executive functioning, but that doesn't really answer the legal question, right? Because, for example, in the case of a competency evaluation, someone can have an intellectual disability or have, you know, schizophrenia and be like very ill, but still be competent. And so a lot of the psychological tests that we have just aren't that relevant for answering that legal question. And really, because a diagnosis isn't the same as a legal opinion, the focus is really more on the functional ability. So what can a person do? Like, yes, they may be experiencing auditory hallucinations, but can they still understand the evidence that could be used against them in court in order to make a legal decision for themselves, right? Can they still provide relevant information to their attorney?
Right, right. Just hearing you talk about it, it seems like that would be hard to decouple these things in my mind. What was that process like for you, especially because you didn't, you were not like forensically trained from the very beginning, right? You kind of moved into that world. So yeah, I'm curious what that was like for you. Was that tough? Was it easy? Like, how do you navigate that?
No, I was caught totally off guard. Like, it was, I think, my first supervision on internship. And my supervisor just kind of said offhand something like, oh yeah, I don't do a ton of testing in my competency evaluations. And I feel like there must have been a little bit of like smoke coming out of my ears because I was short circuiting. Like, I don't understand. You do evaluations, but you don't necessarily do testing. Mm-hmm. And I think initially it felt really uncomfortable because I think, especially as I wasn't even early career professional, it was pre-career professional, I felt just a lot more comfortable having numbers to stand on, you know, well, here is a number from a test. And so it felt really uncomfortable wading out into this area without some hard numbers to attach an opinion to and say, well, here's what they said, here's what they could do, here's my opinion.
Right. Yeah, I think a lot of us get into testing for better or worse because there are numbers and that gives us a little sense of security, even though that maybe is, you know, not totally true. But still, that's a hard thing to just leap without that safety net. Yeah. So this is interesting. I mean, you talk a lot about the value of collateral interviews and record review. And I wanted to go back and just ask, you know, when you say that sometimes you're reviewing hundreds of pages of records, I'm just curious very practically what your system is for doing that, you know, because I've been involved, I've done, let's just say, a handful of not forensic evals, but through DHS or, the foster system or something. And there's hundreds of pages of records. And I'm just like, what do I do with all this? You know, so I'm curious how you handle just massive amounts of records to review.
When I'm going through, there are usually major things that I'm looking for. So anything that gives information about a diagnosis, anything about the nature of treatment. So anything that speaks to whether it was, there was inpatient or whether they were prescribed medication, their response to treatment. And then I really find the notes helpful. So if someone had some sort of inpatient hospitalization, for example, I will look pretty closely to see, okay, well, how are they doing when they were being observed? Having, I guess, some specific bullet points of what data am I really going to need, helps me kind of get through information more quickly. Mm-hmm. If sometimes there's like hundreds of pages of just medical charts that don't mean anything to me or are like scribbled handwriting. So, you know, those, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on those. I'm really going to spend more time looking for those kind of factors that I mentioned.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then I have an outline of notes that just helps me be able to go back and find information.
Sure. So this
I'm probably not the most efficient at it because I think I'm still developing a system to it. And I think fortunately that's built into my schedule of being, you know, it's known that there are going to be times where I'm going to have a case with 1500 pages of records to review. And so that kind of gets factored into the workload. So I feel like I have the time to, you know, to review those kinds of records.
Right. And just continuing with those very pragmatic theme, how do you bill for that time? I've heard folks bill by the inch or bill by the page count or bill for the time it takes. How do you approach that?
Yeah. So when I'm In my private practice, you mean?
Yes.
Yeah. So I just keep track of my time. And if, I mean, I guess if there's like a, I'm somewhere between, not on a exact hour, you know, I just bill like a quarter hour, half hour.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. That's great. And are you using, sorry, I'm going very deep on this for some reason, but I'm very curious of the logistics. Are you flipping printed pages, or are these PDFs and you have software that, are you like scanning or searching for specific words within these documents? How's that look?
So I don't get, I'm trying to think if there's been a time I've gotten paper records, but it's pretty rare. If I do get any kind of paper, it's usually electronic. There's not always a way, just depending on the format, to search. So I would say more often than not, I truly am just scrolling through, just really quickly scanning for like any keywords. Yeah.
That's fair. That's fair. Yeah. Again, my brain is very concrete sometimes. And so I'm just thinking of these instances where I mean, I have had stacks of paper, like 2 feet tall, just it's like, what do I do with this? So I'm very curious how this works for folks who do it more often.
I have known people too, who will hire someone to review for them and then make an outline of relevant data. So I don't personally do that, but I'm sure that sounds great.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Note to self. Hire an assistant. Cool. Cool. Well, I don't know if I've totally taken us off track in terms of these differences between forensic and therapeutic evaluation, but if there's anything to wrap up there, any other major differences that we need to highlight, let's do that before we go deeper.
Yeah. I think just in terms of, I talked about like legal guidelines that guide forensics, then there's also some ethical guidelines. So we have the specialty forensic guidelines. And one of the biggest differences is being able to offer an opinion on in a situation where you weren't able to directly assess the examinee. So I think that's a pretty big difference.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that would be very challenging for many of us.
Yeah. I mean, it can be. It depends on, you know, the extent of those collateral records and interviews.
Yeah. I know I keep drawing parallels with my own sort of limited experience, but it does have me thinking about so we've waded into these pseudo forensic evaluations where we are being asked to evaluate inmates before they're released to make recommendations for community resources. These are individuals who might have low IQ or autism or some other mental health concern that hasn't been previously identified. And so we use that to identify community resources. And these challenges are really, I think they're very present, you know, because these individuals typically are not good historians. We don't often have collateral interviews or records to look at because they're hard to track down or maybe don't exist or something. And then we end up, in this place of making some kind of diagnostic opinion or treatment recommendation opinion based on very limited data. And I'm curious if that has come up in your experience at all. And if so, you know, how you navigate some of those challenges with a population that can be, you know, hard to accurately assess.
Yeah. I mean, sometimes I, you know, if I'm unable to evaluate the examinee and there's just not enough data, then I will say if I feel I cannot offer an opinion, then I will just, I will say that there's not enough data. Here's what I would need in order to be able to give an opinion. But at this point, there's not enough data and I'm not going to just guess, you know.
So, that's fair.
Yeah. So if there's not, so that's one way that I will go about it. If there's truly just not enough data, but sometimes it's just getting creative with finding other ways to get that data. So, I mean, one area where I have seen this come up before in Atkins evaluations. So Atkins v. Virginia was a landmark case law where the Supreme Court ruled that it was inhumane to give the death penalty to individuals who have an intellectual disability. And so that's an area where it can get really tricky. So if someone's been in custody for a really long time, there's no collateral records from before, no one really to interview, that can get really hard, especially with things like, you know, for giving an ID diagnosis. Obviously, it's not just that cognitive testing, it's also looking at that adaptive functioning. But someone's been in prison for 20 years, you know, I'm not sure how you really assess that if you're not able to get some sort of outside data about that person, especially since, like many clinical measures, the adaptive functioning measures weren't developed or normed and really aren't appropriate to be given in a situation where someone's in that kind of a structured environment like prison, just because it's not the way that they function in prison is not necessarily going to be representative of how they function outside. Sure. So that can be a really difficult area to wade into.
Absolutely. Well, that's validating. I think that also opens the door to for a discussion around just measures, the measures that we use. And like you alluded to, not all of them, or maybe many of them, are standardized on incarcerated individuals. And then it's this whole can of worms of, okay, is that okay to still use these measures if they're not, you know, normed or standardized on that population? So yeah, can we dig into that whole topic for a bit?
Let's take a quick break to hear from our featured partner. The Spectra Indices of Psychopathology provides a hierarchical dimensional look at adult psychopathology. Decades of research into psychiatric disorders have shown that most diagnoses can be integrated into a few broad dimensions. The Spectra measures 12 clinically important constructs of depression, anxiety, social anxiety, PTSD, alcohol problems, severe aggression, antisocial behavior, drug problems, psychosis, paranoid ideation, manic activation, and grandiose ideation. That's a lot. It organizes them into three higher order psychopathology spectra of internalizing, externalizing, and reality impairing. The Spectra is available for paper and pencil assessment or administration and scoring via PAR iConnect. You can learn more at parinc.com/spectra. All right, let's get back to the podcast.
Totally. Yeah, I think maybe it would be worth taking just a step back and kind of talking about the three different categories of testing.
That's great.
So we have clinical assessment instruments, and those are, you know, I think what most psychologists think of when they think of testing, right? Those are our cognitive measures, executive functioning, personality, you know, so like OACE or PAI or MMPI, things like that. The great thing about those measures is that usually there's been a lot of research put into the development. And so they usually have pretty good psychometrics. The downside is that, like you said, they're not normed on, they're not developed for use within a forensic setting. And oftentimes, minorities are underrepresented in those norms, but we know they're overrepresented in the criminal justice population. So that ends up being a pretty big issue. And then kind of going back to what we were talking about before of just, they're not really that relevant to the legal question. You know, they'll talk about some of the clinical functioning pieces, but it's not really going to tell us whether or not a person is competent. And then there's forensically relevant instruments. And so those are tests that they're still clinical measures, but they measure clinical constructs that are most closely related to the legal question. And so those, for example, would be symptom validity measures like the TOM or like the MFAST. There's some measures out there that can be used in parental fitness evaluations or in violence risk assessment. Not really tests, but more guides to data collection, I guess. Mm-hmm. So those are tend to be more relevant, usually don't have quite the same amount of research put into the development. And then we have forensic assessment instruments, which are tests or measures that are designed to assess some sort of specific psycholegal ability. So that would be like a competency tool, for example, or a test that looks at feigned legal incompetence. So those are the kind of three categories. And the forensic assessments instruments are tend to be a lot more, you know, they're relevant, but again, not as much research put into them. So those are the three categories. And so I guess kind of going back to this issue of, well, I often feel pulled between, well, we have these really great tests out there that can measure some aspect of clinical functioning, but it may not be, may not be relevant to this legal question, or the norms may not be that great. And so there's kind of this issue of like, well, what do I do? Do I use the test? Do I not? I think oftentimes it's depending, you know, certainly on the situation, but it can still be appropriate to use a test. But obviously there are some really clear limitations. And so being really explicit about talking about the limitations of the conclusions that can be drawn based on that data.
Yeah, yeah. What kind of wording might you use? Is this happening in the report? Is it happening in another document or out loud? How do you tackle that?
Yeah, so I mean, the first one that comes to mind is I evaluated this individual who had a history of diagnosis for ID, but was also legally blind, and none of the evaluations had even mentioned that might be an issue for interpreting his performance on those tests, even though like half, maybe not quite half, but a lot of the subtests on an intelligence test are going to be visual, right?
Of course.
So when I submitted my report, you know, I said, well, here's what his IQ has been estimated to be. However, you know, he's legally blind. There's been no accommodation made, at least that what I was aware of, like increasing the size of the visual stimuli. So likely this underestimates his true functioning. But even if we administered like the WACE or the Stanford-Binet with these accommodations, it's still not going to be like a valid IQ, just because the tests weren't even normed to have that kind of to be administered in that way, right? So I really just said that it was just a paragraph talking about the limitations of that data.
I see. You know, you've given me a couple answers now that lead me to believe that you're just very straightforward about these facts or limitations. You know, you've said a couple times, well, I just say that. And is that kind of a widely accepted practice? It seems like it should be, right? Like we just say what we need to say and be direct. But I have seen so many instances of, fluffy language or sort of, you know, obfuscating the data, you know, like not being clear.
Yeah, I don't know if it's, you know, the most common approach. I know that a lot of sort of leading individuals in the field really advocate for being as transparent about the limitations to our opinions or to the data. And I mean, that's even in our ethical guidelines, right? Just being really clear about any limitations. But I do think, you know, I can certainly relate to this pull of wanting to be helpful and maybe not feeling like, well, if I give this opinion that has all these caveats, you know, the court just wants to know, like, yes or no, is this person, whatever, are they competent or not or whatever? So I can certainly empathize with that pull to just give some information in a more black and white way. But there are individuals out there, Terry Cooker, for example, who has advocated for having a whole section in the report about data that conflicts with our opinion and the limitations to our opinion, and just being really clear, like, this data doesn't fit with our opinion. And, you know, ultimately here's why I still feel like why I landed on this opinion as opposed to something else. But, and then that way the fact finder has all of the data and they can do with it what they will. If they decide they don't like our opinion, they disagree, then they at least have that data.
Yeah, I like that. It seems transparent and comprehensive. Yeah. But not defensive. Makes sense to me.
And I think it makes, I do think it makes evaluators look more credible. And I think it can make testimony go easier. I think if you aren't acknowledging some of that weakness and then you get asked about it and you weren't forthcoming in your report, I think that can look problematic.
Sure. Sure. That makes me think of another question, which is this idea of, you know, putting everything in the report. I think at least on the therapeutic evaluation side, there's actually been more of a push over the last few years to write briefer reports that really include the most important info that people are, you know, that our referral sources need. But I get the sense that may not be the case in the forensic realm. Is that, what would you say about that?
It's really hard, I think, line to walk. It's a process for me of, you know, I think the emphasis is still including information that's relevant, and not including information that doesn't need to be put out there. You know, so really thinking about each sentence that I write of, okay, why am I putting this in my report? How does this inform my opinion? And if I don't really have a good explanation for it, then I take it out. And I think that has been really hard just because of, you know, how I was trained to write therapeutic reports. And I think just my natural perseverative style is to just include as much information as possible. But yeah, the focus really should just be on whatever data is relevant to the legal question. So they don't necessarily need to be these super detailed reports. You know, if you've reviewed 1500 pages of records, that doesn't mean you need to have like a really detailed, lengthy background. It's more like, okay, what data in there is relevant? And what does the court need to know about that data?
Yeah. It is a fine line. It's hard to figure out what's relevant sometimes. And I think a lot of us err on the side of more information so that we don't miss anything that's relevant rather than less information than we might miss relevant material. It's tough. I don't have an answer either. I think we're all kind of wrestling with this, you know, what qualifies as relevant and what do we actually need to put in our reports? I was curious if there's a clear distinction in the forensic realm, you know, where we could say, hey, you should probably include more if you had to make a choice.
I wouldn't say that that's generally a rule that they should include more. Because again, just thinking about how that report, you know, who knows what will happen with that data once it's put out there and how that could affect things that are not relevant to that specific question.
Great point. It's a great point. Okay. I appreciate you answering all these curveball questions. Yeah. The audience doesn't know this. I don't think I've asked a single question that we talked about before we started this podcast. So I'm just going to, in the interest of being transparent, Casey's doing great on this interview. But I do want to actually talk about something that we've kind of hinted at, we've touched on, but it is pretty important. And you know, this topic of how individuals with lower IQ or suspected lower IQ and how we navigate effort testing in those individuals and just what that looks like. That seems fraught, but this is something that you think a lot about. And I'm curious how you approach that problem.
Yeah, I think you hit the nail on the head with that word fraught, I think is an apt description. It's really challenging. And I don't think there is a really straightforward answer to it, because what we do know is that individuals with lower IQ tend to do worse on effort measures. We get higher rates of false positives among those individuals, that they just don't quite get the nature of the test in the way that someone with a more average IQ would understand it and would interact with the process. So, and I think also just thinking about, you know, a lot of the manuals will say this test is not appropriate for an individual with an IQ below 60, but even that 60 to 70 range can still be problematic. I mean, we can still see higher rates of false positives. And then if you just look at the norms in, you know, like in the manual, they're just, that population tends to be underrepresented in the research development of the test. So I don't know. I mean, I don't know what's being done to address the situation. You know, I'm not aware of any tests out there that are specifically for individuals with ID to get it effort.
I don't know of any specifically. Yeah. Yeah, it's a huge challenge. Maybe we take a step back too, just to provide a little bit of context here around, you know, what situations are you doing an IQ test, or would you be doing effort testing in forensic settings?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it's definitely not always relevant, right? Kind of going back to that issue of whether or not the data is relevant. It certainly can come up in competency evaluations, right? So is a person not able to understand or appreciate information about their case? Are they not able to learn that information because of some sort of cognitive issue, like an intellectual disability? So that's one place. Those Atkins evaluations that I mentioned. So if someone has been convicted and they're facing the death penalty, those evaluations, certainly IQ is going to be assessed. Places where it's less relevant would be things like child custody evaluations, right? Focusing more on the like parental capabilities. You know, they might have lower IQ, but be very great parents. Yeah. So those are some of the areas that come to mind immediately where IQ is going to be really important.
That's fair. Yeah. It seems like there'd be a motivation for some individuals to try to present themselves as having a lower IQ in some circumstances. Does that come up, and how do you work through that?
Yeah, I mean, there can be issues. I mean, I'm always thinking about how valid or accurate those test results are, you know, whether or not somebody is. But I mean, all my reports will speak to the response style and the validity of the test results. And so this is kind of going back to how we talked about the collateral data being a really important part. So looking at, you know, does the person have a history of academic problems, like really poor grades or special education? Anything, and to be fair, like that may not always be there in the history for someone who truly does have an intellectual disability. But those would be things that I would, that I look for. Like, are there, is there this pervasive pattern of low functioning outside of just this low test score? And, you know, just data from either jail staff or if they're in treatment. So is there, are there discrepancies in their presentation? Are they, do they present one way when they know they're being monitored versus when they think they're not being monitored? Are there significant discrepancies there? Yeah, those would be some big areas that I would be looking at to kind of determine whether or not this person may be feigning or malingering.
Right, right. Okay, that makes sense to me. Yeah, I as we keep talking, it seems like what's true for a lot of evaluations is true here as well, just that collateral information is so valuable. And the more, the longer I do this, I feel like the clearer it gets that our testing data is just one component of an evaluation, and the collateral information and records and history are often far more important.
Oh, totally, totally. I can think of, I mean, even thinking about more therapeutic evaluations that I've done where, you know, the test data, I felt really pulled to one conclusion, and then I talked to a family member and was like, oh, I've got this all wrong. You know, here's some really rich data. And no, it's not a test score, but it's very useful nonetheless.
Right, right, right. Well, and as we're, you know, meandering about in this topic of IQ and effort and diagnosis and so forth, you know, it makes me think back to the adaptive functioning question. And, you know, we know that a big component of diagnosing an intellectual disability is adaptive functioning. And how are you making up for that? How are you just approaching assessing adaptive functioning when the, again, the measures may not be standardized for this population, or they might not be reliable reporters? How do we look at that?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's definitely going to be breaking from standardized, you know, administration. One way that I've seen it done in an Atkins evaluation, I didn't do it, but I was working with an evaluator who did, and she ended up, there were family members alive. This person had been incarcerated for a very, very long time, but she asked them to fill those out retrospectively. I think she asked jail or, you know, prison staff to also rate them, and just was really clear, you know, this test data, like, this is not valid. These numbers aren't valid. This is not how these measures were meant to be given, but there's really no other way, you know, to get at this information. And she, you know, she interviewed family members, interviewed prison staff, and then reviewed as much data as she could get from before that person went to prison. But I mean, it was just, she just really had to be clear about the limitations that she could draw based on that data.
I appreciate you setting forth this model, basically, to that it's okay to say these are the limitations, and basically I'm doing the best that I can with the data that's out there. That's important. So let's see. I mean, we've covered a lot of different topics. I know there's a lot that we could continue to talk about or dive into. But yeah, let's see. I mean, I am curious how you talk about effort testing in the forensic setting. And how you present that either to the individual or to the court.
Like when I'm administering the effort.
Sure. Yeah, let's start there. So you're in the middle of an evaluation. It seems clear effort is not good. What do you do?
So, I mean, fortunately, a lot of the effort measures out there have a pretty clear script about how to introduce it. And sometimes I have mixed feelings about different tests and the way that it's worded, just because of some seem to incorporate elements of suggestibility, which I think is, I mean, obviously that's very problematic, getting back to the low IQ population.
Mm-hmm.
But I just in general don't love that approach of how some of the measures incorporate this language that seems a bit misleading. But so when I'm administering it, there's nothing really different than how you would go about testing in any other kind of setting. You know, just kind of, I just introduce what we're going to be doing and I don't really say much about it. And then, I mean, and sometimes, I mean, sometimes I will have cases where it's very clear that the person is feigning, and you know, they will answer questions in a way that's just very clearly inaccurate. You know, it's inconsistent with their presentation, or it's just a bizarre question that they're asked that they answer in some way that, you know, it's like, this is very, to me, it seems very clear what the question is getting at. But so that's always, I guess, sometimes I feel a little uncomfortable just navigating that, you know, when someone gives me an answer where I'm just like, this is, it's just obvious that this person's not
right
being forthcoming. And they don't realize that it's obvious that they're not being forthcoming. But I don't, you know, I don't discuss it with them. Sometimes they'll ask me questions. Like, I've had somebody on a measure of malingered psychopathology, you know, they were like, well, these are really symptoms people experience, you know, this is totally what I experience. And I just, you know, couldn't really talk about it, you know, just on to the next question.
Right.
And then in the reports, you know, I just explain what the test measures, you know, in a sentence or two. And then just usually just a brief overview, you know, this score is or is not consistent with whatever, feigned psychopathology or feigned legal incompetence, whatever it is. And then depending on how detailed the measure is, you know, I might kind of break down, you know, like something like the CSRS gives you a lot more data about how the person might be feigning. So I might go into detail and say, you know, specifically here's the way that they presented.
Sure. Great. Well, I wonder, maybe I'll start to close with the question that I asked at the beginning, which is, you know, threading that needle between building rapport with your client when you know at the same time that the test results may not go in their favor, and how you reconcile that maybe cognitive dissonance, and if that, just how you work through that kind of emotionally for yourself.
Yeah, I don't know that the cognitive dissonance is ever fully resolved for me. I think it doesn't matter what the person, you know, is accused of doing or kind of the context of the situation. I think every time I'm sitting with someone and I know that they are facing a very serious situation, that's, I very much feel that sitting with them. And I have this sense of, like, this person's life is going to be very hard. I don't know how it's going to turn out for them, but I know they've got a long haul ahead of them. And so I think just, you know, I am always aware of that, and I, you know, because I acknowledge it, and also acknowledge that it's not really, I guess, my mind to take on, and it's not really my place to even kind of foray into that. I just am aware. I think it gives me comfort knowing that I feel that way when I see defendants, because I think I, you know, helps me recognize that, like, this is a person in front of me. And I think it just for me, it's a motivator to just be as fair as I can. I'm just, you know, here, I'm not going to stray outside of the data. This is what I know. And this is what I can say based on that. And, you know, I also know that, you know, the attorneys have a role in this. If they don't, depending on who ordered the evaluation, you know, they can decide what they want to do with that report, right?
Right.
And I think I also just know that the way that I think about an opinion in a report, I think, is maybe different than how the court interprets it. You know, I just, for example, when I give the opinion that someone is feigning, for example, in the past, I've worried that that's going to be this huge issue, and it doesn't really seem that the court takes it as this. I mean, it's certainly useful data, right? But it's not like I don't see them being punished, you know, because I give that opinion that they're, you know, feigning. It may not help them in the way that their attorney was hoping.
Sure. It's a good reminder. We can only have so much responsibility in this whole process.
And I think, you know, in terms of rapport, I mean, I am always really clear at the beginning about the nature and the purpose of the evaluation. And I always remind them, you know, you don't have to answer my questions. I will still have to write a report, but, you know, if there's something that you don't want to talk about, that's fine. And I think that goes a long way with people, of just knowing that they have some autonomy in the process, even if it's a small piece of autonomy.
I gotcha. Do you deal with much, it seems like in my experience, with the incarcerated individuals I've evaluated, that they seem to fall into two camps. Like, there are those who are very invested in the process and kind of excited and want to be cooperative and very, you know, they believe in like the possibility for help, and then others that are mostly suspicious and very guarded and unwilling to participate. And I'm curious, one, I mean, does that match your experience? And two, how do you work with that suspicious side to build rapport with folks who may not want to participate?
Well, if someone seems from the get-go just not interested, very suspicious, I just ask them, like, do you have questions for me? Is there anything that I can clarify? Do you have any concerns about meeting with me? You know, just being willing to answer whatever questions they might have about the process. A lot of times, I think individuals that don't want to participate, it's also pretty clear that they're also very ill and not receiving any kind of treatment. And so in those cases, there's not a lot that I really can do. You know, a lot of times offering to clarify any questions or concerns isn't really gonna go, you know, isn't gonna be worth a lot to them.
Great point. Yes. It's tough sometimes. But again, good reminder. Yeah. We can only do what we can do.
Yeah. And I mean, I think just incorporating basic aspects of building rapport. I mean, I think I really try to be very clear about, like, this is not therapy. So I'm not really asking therapeutic type questions, but just talking to them like they're, you know, a person, like you would, just to, you know, how their day's going, things like that.
Yeah. Great. This is great. Well, I know we could talk about so many other things, and we have really sort of detoured around here and there, and I appreciate your willingness to answer some of these curveball questions. But yeah, as we do start to wrap up, I am curious, just from your perspective, anything that you feel like you want to highlight or mention again before we say goodbye, you know, folks who may be listening and, you know, curious about this topic, anything we missed that worth
necessarily anything we missed, but I think, you know, I talked about the discomfort that I felt when moving away from using testing in every single evaluation and being more open to using other sources of data. I think anyone out there who shares that discomfort, I think I now that I've like worked through that discomfort, I find it really like liberating that I can be really creative in how I get the data that I need. Testing is one way to do it, but it's not the only way. And there's a lot of ways to get really useful, valid data. And I think that I've carried that back with me to doing the more therapeutic evaluations. Testing is one tool, not the only tool.
I like that. I think that's a really nice note to end on, because I think, like I said, the longer that I do this, the less I think I rely on testing data, objective testing data from cognitive measures and so forth, that these other ways of gathering information are so valuable. And the sooner we can break free of the data, the better, I think.
Totally. And you use the word objective, and I have such a hard time with that word because I think that's how a lot of us think about test data. Mm-hmm. But I always feel cautious about that just because at the end of the day, yes, it's a number, but we're still integrating that data, right? And in the process of integrating, we are interpreting, which is an inherently subjective process, right? And sometimes we get data that conflict, you know, test results that conflict. And so that's where we have to come in with our clinical judgment, right? And say, okay, well, how can we make sense of this data? And so I think I don't really think of test data as like objective, you know? Mm-hmm. But I think that's like a really common sentiment. The test data is objective. Everything else is subjective.
That's such a good point. No, I so appreciate you saying that. I agree 100% that it's like the myth of objectivity, I suppose. That, yeah, we have numbers. We did administer a test. We did get a score. And there are so many factors influencing that score that it is hard to say it's truly objective, right? Our behavior, the examinee's behavior, the, you know, environmental factors, any number of things.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, this is good. That's a bit of a cliffhanger that we can end on. We could talk a lot more just about that, but yeah, in another way, I think it's a nice way to kind of tie a bow on this stuff and just encourage folks to say, you know, hey, there's lots of other data you can gather, and you know, testing doesn't have to be the only way.
Absolutely.
Yeah, I appreciate your time, Casey. This is really interesting for me, and like I said, I just appreciate your willingness to talk about some things that weren't necessarily on the script. So, thank you.
My pleasure. Yeah. Thanks for having me.
All right, y'all. Thank you so much for tuning into this episode. Always grateful to have you here. I hope that you take away some information that you can implement in your practice and in your life. Any resources that we mentioned during the episode will be listed in the show notes, so make sure to check those out. If you like what you hear on the podcast, I would be so grateful if you left a review on iTunes or Spotify or wherever you listen to your podcasts. And if you're a practice owner or aspiring practice owner, I'd invite you to check out the Testing Psychologist Mastermind Groups. I have mastermind groups at every stage of practice development: beginner, intermediate, and advanced. We have homework, we have accountability, we have support, we have resources. These groups are amazing. We do a lot of work and a lot of connecting. If that sounds interesting to you, you can check out the details at thetestingpsychologist.com/consulting. You can sign up for a pre-group phone call and we will chat and figure out if a group could be a good fit for you. Thanks so much. The information contained in this podcast and on the Testing Psychologist website are intended for informational and educational purposes only. Nothing in this podcast or on the website is intended to be a substitute for professional psychological, psychiatric, or medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment. Please note that no doctor-patient relationship is formed here, and similarly, no supervisory or consultative relationship is formed between the host or guests of this podcast and listeners of this podcast. If you need the qualified advice of any mental health practitioner or medical provider, please seek one in your area. Similarly, if you need supervision on clinical matters, please find a supervisor with an expertise that fits your needs.